each other, but I'll try to show you in the course of the talk why they have something to do with each other. So, to start off, I just want to say that I think the headline that you hear sort of from coupling constant unification is that it's strong evidence for the minimal supersymmetric standard model. The couplings unify very nicely, and this is so unlikely that these three lines would meet at this point, and this point is exactly where you want it to be, that it's safe from the point of view of lots of things like proton decay. So it seems to be strong evidence for the MSSM. People actually go a step further, and it's arguments against extra-dimensional theories that address the hierarchy problem. So theories with extra dimensions where it's tried to be addressed. So the question I want to ask in the first part of the talk is it really true that we have to abandon high-scale unification due to logarithmic running of couplings in the context of additional dimensions? And if additional dimensions which are addressing the hierarchy problem, that is to say they do have a TEV scale built in. Okay. So what I'm going to try to argue is that it's not only possible, it's actually quite natural to expect this kind of thing might happen in the solution to the hierarchy based on the warp factor that I'll talk about momentarily. So what I want to do in this talk is first I'm going to tell you about the problems with unification in extra dimensions, why it was thought you can't have high-scale unification in these models. And then I'm going to explain that why it's different in the case of large flat extra dimensions and relatively small curved extra dimension, in particular ADS5 with boundaries. So then to actually show that this is true and believe it, we actually did the field theory calculation in ADS5 rather than try to invoke some holographic principle or something. We actually did it directly in ADS5. As we'll see, that involved using a position-dependent cutoff for reasons that I'll explain. And so we found, in fact, that you get logarithmic running and more or less expect them to unify. And I'll explain what more or less means when I talk in more detail about the calculation and results. So that's the first part of the talk. And depending on time, what I want to do is tell you about some recent work. This was work done with Matthew Schwartz. This is more recent work done in collaboration with Matthew Schwartz and Veronica Sands. Where we actually extrapolate the method that we used to do the ADS-Phi to other curved spaces and basically use it to count states. The basic observation being in the first part of the talk, we found that we did a calculation in the five-dimensional space. We found logarithmic running of the coupling, which is a reflection of acting like a four-dimensional field theory, although it was done in ADS-5. And so is that telling us something about the degrees of freedom in the space? And so can we extrapolate our regularization and cutoff procedure to other curved spaces to count states? And in fact, we can. And we have applied it to several examples, but I'll show de Sitter as an example and then conclude. Okay. So first of all, why is it thought that you can't unify at a high energy when you have extra dimensions and address the hierarchy problem? So first, let's consider the case of large flat extra dimensions that resolve that address the hierarchy problem. I remind you that the idea there was there a fundamental scale of mass M, TV. This is Arkani, Hamed, Demopoulos, Duvalli. There's a fundamental scale M of order TV. M Planck, that's a very high scale, is related to this scale M because it's so much higher than M, we need a large volume. Okay, so the idea is that there's a large volume, so large flat extra dimensions. In this theory, the idea is that M is really the fundamental scale TeV. You generate the scale M Planck because of the large volume. Okay, so M is the fundamental scale. It's the quantum gravity scale. It's basically the maximum energy scale in the theory, roughly speaking. Clearly, we see that the couplings aren't unified at MZ. They'd have to run extremely rapidly to unify at a TeV. That's not going to happen in these models. It's not going to run rapidly enough. The rest of this has to do with the fact that people have considered unification of couplings in the context of extra dimensions. But of course, if you're going to do that, you need the couplings to run very rapidly. And they do run rapidly. They run like a power law. This doesn't work in the case of the models that address the hierarchy, but I do want to go over why things run like a power law. And although this is trivial, it'll be useful in understanding what's different about the example I'll consider next. Okay. So what's going on is in four dimensions, of course, you get logarithmic running, you get d4p over p to the fourth if you calculate some correction, say, to the self-energy of the gluon. In n extra dimensions, that is to say n more than 4, you'd find that it went like a power law, ratio of energies to the nth power. Another way to think of this is, suppose we had n extra dimensions of some size r, and then you can think of it in the four-dimensional picture as the result of the fact that we have a ton of Kaluza-Klein modes that are contributing to the running. So rather than do the calculation in the higher-dimensional theory, let's think about the calculation in a four-dimensional theory. In the four-dimensional theory, we'd have a lot of Kaluza-Klein modes if r is big. In particular, for at a given momentum p, we would have pr for each dimension. So we find that we get something like the four-dimensional answer times pr to the n, which would again tell you that you're getting this power law running. But in this way of thinking about it, you see that what's going on is that there's this huge number of Kaluza-Klein modes, and that's the reason you're seeing power law running rather than logarithmic running. Okay. So in any case, in the context of large extra dimensions, it's clear that high-scale unification isn't possible since the maximum energy scale is about a TeV. So now let's consider an alternative theory that addresses the hierarchy. This is the one I did with Sundrum, where we have the Planck brain and a TeV brain in ADS5 in the bulk. So there's ADS5 here. This is basically a UV cutoff from the point of view of the dual field theory. This is the IR cutoff. But in any case, there are two brains in the theory. The metrics has this form. When I use the coordinate r, it's dying exponentially as a function of distance. Okay. This addresses the hierarchy if this brain is stabilized some distance away from the Planck brain. But the nice thing is it's not a huge distance. Because it's dying exponentially, the distance is determined by the logarithm of the ratio of these scales. So rather than be numbers like 10 to the 16th, it's a number like 30. Okay. So this is a rather modest distance away, and with that, if you can stabilize it at that distance, you would naturally see that there's a hierarchy of scales. That is to say, the natural scale here would be the Planck scale, whereas the natural scale there is the TeV scale. Now, there's a couple of reasons that this is really different. Okay, the first thing we see is that this is not that big. Now, why that's important for us at this point is that that allows us to consider the option of putting gauge bosons not just on the TeV brain, but in the bulk. Okay, and in order to address the hierarchy problem, you need to have the Higgs on the TeV brain. For simplicity, we thought the entire standard model was on the TeV brain when we first wrote down the theory. But in fact, if you don't have such a big extra dimension, it's perfectly acceptable to think of the gauge bosons as being in the bulk. Okay. Why is that a good thing? Well, if you think about it, the bulk, although if we live on the TeV brain, we see things getting strongly coupled at about a TeV. So that would be sort of the highest scale of the theory you would see for fields on the TeV brain. If you look in the bulk, the TeV is not the maximum scale of the theory. In fact, what you would see as the maximum energy scale would depend on your location in the bulk. So the maximum energy scale is some number of order m Planck, the true quantum gravity scale in this theory. That is to say, to understand four-dimensional gravity, would be of order m Planck, not of order TeV. Okay, so at different positions in the bulk, you see different energies. So we're way ahead of the game because we actually do have high energy scales, and if the gauge bosons are in the bulk, they access those high energy scales. So there's some hope to talk about unification at a high energy scale. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. What's the other thing that's very different? The other thing that's different is that although it's a five-dimensional theory, you don't have power law running. And it's actually rather simple to understand why it's not power law running from the point of view of the Kaluza-Klein modes, which is why I gave that additional argument. What does the spectrum look like if we have a gauge boson in the bulk? Okay, if we have a gauge boson in the bulk, we're going to have a zero mode, which would play the role of the gluon, the photon, etc., of the four-dimensional. And there will be Kaluza-Klein excitations as well. Okay. If we have this TeV brain, the Kaluza-Klein excitations would be, say, a massive order of TeV. So it would be TeV, 2TeV, 3TeV. And they're peaked near the TeV brain. But the important thing is that we actually reach the strong coupling scale pretty soon above that. There's not going to be a large range between K, this what I call K, which sets the ADS curvature scale, which in turn sets the mass of the Kaluza Klein modes, and lambda, which is the cutoff, which is of order M, which is whatever the five-dimensional gravity scale is in theory, both of them times the warp factor. So in other words, lambda, the cutoff, divided by K, which sets the mass for the Kaluza Klein modes, is some number of order 1 or 10. It's not a big number. Okay, that is to say, there's only a few Kaluza Klein modes in the theory. Okay. So in other words, there are not, the number of Kaluza-Klein modes doesn't go like M Planck over TV. The number of Kaluza-Klein modes goes like lambda over K, which is some number of order 5. So if you were to calculate running in the four-dimensional theory, you wouldn't expect to see a huge power law running. You'd expect to see this number, maybe something like 1 plus lambda over K, 1 for the zero mode, lambda over K for the Kaluza-Klein modes, times the standard beta function. So it would be logarithmic running, maybe multiplied by some small number, like lambda over K. Okay, but it's logarithmic running. This lambda over K is sort of hinting at power law running, but again, it's not a huge ratio. It's not M Planck over TV. We're talking about a number here that's like 4 or 5. Okay, so that's a major difference. And in this theory, we really do expect to see logarithmic running. Okay. It might be that it runs a little bit faster because the lambda over K might be a number greater than 1, but it will be logarithmic. Okay. Exactly how we approach the unification depends on what we assume from the model. All I really want to show is that it's quite natural, given the measured values of the coupling in the context of this theory, to imagine that the couplings unify. Or in other words, if there was a unified theory or the couplings were identical, it's very natural to imagine that they run down to the values that we observe. Okay. If you do have a full gut representation, this lambda over K effect will basically respect SU5 and it would cancel and you would get unification roughly at 10 to the 16th GeV. If you don't have the full gut representation, then you would expect it at something lower because the running would be faster multiplied by lambda over K. Okay. All right. So what we want to do is we want to calculate the relation between the measured couplings, which are measured down at the Z, or TV, and high-energy coupling, where the theory is truly five-dimensional. Okay, but it's obviously not going to be like a standard field theory calculation, although it'll be quite close. But we are in curved space, and we have to somehow incorporate the fact that we have this reduced number of states that I just said.
There's a scale. You discussed the scale of the size of the of this fifth dimension.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the scale of the radius of curvature of the ADS? What do you want to take that to be?
So K is of order lambda, which is of order M Planck. I mean, all the scales are basically the same.
An anti-de-Sitter space with a Planck scale radius of curvature.
I mean, for consistency, K has to be somewhat less than lambda, just so K over lambda is small and I can trust gravity.
So if I was thinking about this in the context of ABS CFT or something,
mm-hmm.
I would say it's a relatively small number of...
N is a relatively small. N has to be about 10 for a reason. It's constrained because you want things to happen. You want the ADS curvature scale to be less than the cutoff scale or the Planck scale. But also you don't want the couplings to run so fast that you hit that they blow up so quickly. And because there's effectively an extra logarithm that comes with N. Right, so I don't want N to be so big that they would blow up before the grand unification scale. So you want N to be something like 5 or 10 for that to be true. So it's not really in the large N regime. So I didn't entirely... you might ask, why don't we just say, well, it's obvious that it's logarithmic. Why don't we do the holographic calculation? So there's sort of two reasons. One is that we're not really in the regime where we trust it. N isn't that big. But I think more important... We want to really understand what we're doing. And what we're doing is we're really calculating the coupling of the zero mode. The zero mode is a mode, and I really mean the zero mode here, not an effective zero mode, but the zero mode. That is to say, there's two brains, and there's a zero mode that's normalizable. If there's only one brain, there wouldn't be this normalizable zero mode. So in the context of ADS-CFT, it's better understood if there's just a single brain. Or it's better understood if there's no brains at all. Then you can put in one brain and have an ultraviolet cutoff. But to understand the zero mode, you need the infrared cutoff too. And it wasn't clear how much that was going to get involved in what was going on.
Well, any theory that has a mass gap or that has a mass scale has an infrared brain.
That's correct. That's right. But how does that feed into this? How does that feed into where you're evaluating the coupling? I'll mention that at the end, but I think we learned a lot by doing the calculation in the bulk, and that's what learned. I think there's actually some interesting tests to go back and see what the holographic calculation gives for reasons that I'll discuss. So, I mean, we weren't actually shocked by the answer. I mean, we sort of expected this to happen, but we wanted to know what the answer was, and we didn't really trust the calculations. Okay, so the question was how to do this calculation in a way that we trusted. Okay. So there were several possibilities. One is the holographic calculation, which I just mentioned. And I mentioned also why we didn't entirely trust it. One was to do the full...
Holographic means using field theory.
Yeah, but with the doing field theory. That's right. It's actually, in some sense, it's easier to do the calculation in the bulk in some ways, because if you do it from the boundary, then you have to worry about the conformal field theory modes, which carry SU5 or 3-2-1, and so you have to have those running. And again, it's not really large N, and again, you don't really know what's going on in the infrared. So those were potential problems there. And in fact, I'll show you why it's not exactly clear that we would have gotten the right answer when I finish. In particular, this lambda over K. It would be interesting to understand, but I'll come back to that. For now, I'm going to talk about more conventional methods, not using a duality, but just doing the calculation either in the 5D theory or in effective theory. So in the literature, there was actually some stuff that was done with polyvelars. In that case, they hadn't really realized that you didn't have to live on the Planck brain. That is to say that you could address the hierarchy at the same time you had unification. But there were calculations done with polyvelars. We were a little bit concerned about using polyvelars just because there's ghosts, and there's basically ghosts at your cutoff scale. It's in conventional polyvelars calculations, you can take the polyvelars mass to infinity. In fact, that's what you're supposed to do. In this calculation, you can't take the polyvelars mass to infinity. If you take the polyvelars mass to infinity, you basically are making a large region of flat space. So you want to keep that it corresponds to taking lambda much bigger than K in terms of parameters I just gave. Lambda would be the polyvelars mass. So you really have to keep finite polyvelars mass, which means that your ghosts are basically right there at the limit of your physical energy regime. So we weren't sure we trusted it, although in retrospect, having gotten the answer, we do trust it, because it never is in the physical spectrum. I'll mention that later on, but we were a little bit worried about that, so we wanted to do a calculation in a way that we really were sure we were doing the right thing. Okay. So we just did the full five-dimensional calculation. I'm changing coordinates from R to Z now. We found the Lagrangian. We did gauge fixing. I'm not going to talk about the subtleties of gauge fixing and how we dealt with A5, et cetera. That's all in the paper. I'm not going to talk about those subtleties. Basically, what we want to do is we want to first find the Green's function in the bulk ADS5. Okay? So we're doing it in the bulk. So this is the same equation I wrote down a moment ago. It's the Green's function, equation for the Green's function of the gauge boson in the bulk with momentum P. So you'll notice that we're doing a mixed momentum and space for representation. So from four dimensions we have P, and the fifth dimension we have Z. That's a natural thing to do when Z has finite boundaries. We could have done it all in position space as well, but you definitely want to treat the fifth dimension with Z because there are these brains at positions in Z. Okay. So the solution is some linear combination of Bessel functions, okay, J1 and Y1. Had it been a massive field, it would be like the square root of 1 plus M over K squared. The boundary conditions are determined at the two brains, and the way we found it is we found the boundary condition on one side, found it on the other side, and then matched over the delta function. And so you can find the propagator. That isn't that illuminating. So let me show you a few limits of the propagator, which actually are somewhat illuminating, to tell you what's going on. Okay. So the first limit of this Green's function in this ADS5 is with two brains, is low momentum, much less than T. T is basically the TV scale. It's where that second brain is. And you see that the propagator goes like 1 over Q squared. 1 over Q squared is, of course, what you expect in the four-dimensional theory at low energy, which is below T. Notice that it also has a factor of 1 over R. That's not surprising either. That's the factor that converts you from the five-dimensional gauge coupling to the four-dimensional gauge coupling. So this is precisely what you expect. Okay. Now let's look what happens at somewhat bigger momenta. At bigger momenta, you see, again, a result that you might not be surprised to see. It goes like 1 over Q squared log Q. Okay. Anyone who's considered gauge bosons in the bulk of ADS knows that is, in effect, how the holographic gauge coupling would run. What it represents, essentially, is the fact that when you add up all the Kaluza-Klein modes, you get an effective coupling that goes like 1 over Q squared log Q. So again, this is the behavior that we know should be true. Okay. It's interesting also to consider very, very high momenta on the TEV brain. That is to say, momentum much bigger than a TEV. Now, this is the regime where we said we're going to get cut off pretty quickly. We're not going to be able to go to momenta much higher. But let's look at the regime, say, between K and lambda. Okay, so somewhat, that is to say, K and lambda multiplied by the warp factor, K over Z, lambda over Z. So there will be a regime, and that regime, in fact, will look like flat space, which is what you expect when you get to energy scales such that you can probe inside the ADS curvature scale. Okay, that's what going to Q greater than T means. Okay, so you find the propagator goes like 1 over Q, as you would expect for a five-dimensional flat space propagator. One way of thinking about this is that it's going like 1 over Q squared, but then the number of modes is Q over T, if you think of it in terms of Kaluza-Klein modes. So you expect to see this 1 over Q behavior in this regime. It's also telling you that there better be that the propagator, that whatever physics you're doing gets cut off at a scale lambda not much bigger than T, or else you would see five-dimensional behavior, not four-dimensional behavior. There I had them. I had both points Z on the TV brain. Here I have general points U and V in the fifth dimension. And you see that, not surprisingly, you also need V to be near U in order to get this 1 over Q behavior. Okay, so that's the propagator. It's rather illuminating. But to finish the calculation, we obviously need the vertices. And we'll need to understand exactly what our regularization scheme is. So the vertices are, is fairly trivial. Once you have the Lagrangian, it basically looks like four-dimensional vertices, except for additional factors of 1 over Z. Okay. So I won't say any more about that. But the thing I do want to talk about, which was very interesting, was the question of how to regularize this theory. Because basically that's where this reduction of states comes in that makes this go from looking five-dimensional to looking four-dimensional. So although it doesn't respect gauge invariance, we did the calculation with a cutoff. Okay, as I said, we didn't want to use polyvalores. We know the answer at the end of the day is gauge invariant, so we trust that when it's done correctly, it will be a gauge invariant answer. This was done so that we didn't have ghosts and we could understand what the cutoff behavior really is. Okay. So if you're really upset with the fact that we use it, you can go do it in polyvalores, and it's really doing exactly the same thing as I'm going to show you later on. Okay. But here we actually see what's going on more explicitly. Okay. So suppose you had a cutoff scale lambda on the Planck brain. That is to say, if you had a four-dimensional theory on the Planck brain, you had some cutoff scale lambda. Then by general covariance, you know that point of view of the four-dimensional theory, if you're on some arbitrary position z, the mass scale you see is not lambda, but you see lambda over z. Okay. So basically, any mass scale gets rescaled as I go out in this z direction. So here I see lambda, but here I see something that was more like lambda, that was more like t times lambda over k. So lambda can be a bit bigger than k, so this can be something a little bit bigger than t, but not much bigger. Okay. So the condition that you find is that at a general position z, your cutoff on momentum would be lambda over zk, to say that qz, if q is the momenta, is less than lambda over k. Okay? So this is a condition. So we said before q is less than lambda over kz, but I want to write it this way because I want to impose it as a condition on z. Okay. Okay, so this will be important to understanding our answer, but I just want to point out that what's going on is we have this cutoff, it's coming down, okay? So in each of these slices, we see a lower cutoff. There's, for any given point, though, there's going to be a region that is essentially acting like flat space, which is the region between the scaled version of k and the scaled version of lambda, okay? So this region that corresponds to flat space ranges over all energies, okay? Because if you go out to a different position, you see that you intersect there, any given momentum. The other thing to see is that what we did is, we, as I said, we're going to put a cutoff on z. What that means is that if you're dealing with a particular energy state, sorry about this transparency, so we focus on this picture here, okay? Say this is the warp factor, okay? And say this is the energy E that you're considering, okay? Or Q, okay? So this is the Q that you're considering. What the fact that this cutoff is coming down is telling you is that you're only allowed to have this particular Q for this region of Z. That is to say, if you went to Z that was too big out in this region, you'd now be at a position where your energy is bigger than your effective cutoff scale, and that's not allowed, okay? So a way of imposing the fact that Q is less than lambda over ZK is to impose that Z is less than Z sub Q, okay? Where Z sub Q is that intersection, okay? That looks fine, except there was a puzzle that we had right away, which is if you say that you're only integrating over some finite region, not over this whole region, but over some finite region for any particular Q, there's a puzzle, which is the fact that if you just consider the zero-mode contribution, the zero-mode contribution all by itself should be identical to what you would get in a four-dimensional theory. Okay? Just the zero-mode. Because I could just have integrated over the space, I just have a four-dimensional zero-mode. However, if I'm telling you that at any given momentum Q, I'm not integrating over the whole space, I'm only integrating over part of the space, I'm clearly not going to get the right zero momentum contribution. And that's what these two calculations show you, that you don't actually get the answer that would agree with the fundamentally four-dimensional contribution, which is what this is. What is the resolution to this problem? Well, we believe the resolution is the fact that when you only integrate up to this position, you should actually change your boundary conditions to also correspond to that position. That's certainly in keeping with the holographic principle, or the fact that wherever you see a given energy scale, it should be rescaled. So if I'm telling you that this is where this intersection is, I would expect this also to be the boundary. In other words, one way of thinking of integrating down a momenta is moving this boundary to the right as we integrate down. Okay. But that's a significant statement because you're actually going to impose different boundary conditions for every different value of momenta. But if you do that, you will, of course, get the right answer because your entire propagator fits in this region. Okay? Okay, so there were two steps again. One was that we imposed this cutoff on position in order to impose the ultraviolet cutoff in a generally covariant way. And the other was that we applied new boundary conditions. So the infrared brain is at not at T, but at Z sub Q. Another way of thinking about why this actually makes sense is that if you imagine it from the point of view of the dual field theory, what the infrared brain would be, say, some break-in conformal invariance deep in the infrared. If I'm at some momentum much higher than that, I don't know anything about the existence of a TEV brain even. So it would be surprising if the physics would know about the existence of this TEV brain at these high momenta. So it's very sensible that you would only know about the momenta up to the momenta you can access, which is defined by Z sub Q. Okay. So basically, those were the steps, and we could just do the calculation. And it's the same sort of diagrams that you would get if you were doing a purely four-dimensional calculation. The answer actually resembles a four-dimensional answer, and that's what this represents, but it's multiplied by this factor. So rather than have propagators that go like 1 over q squared, we had the propagators that I showed you earlier, two factors of the propagator. So since I wanted to write it in terms of something that looked like the four-dimensional answer, these q squareds are factored out here. And then there are these additional integrals over u and v, okay, the position of the two vertices. Okay. It turns out that this quantity here is very strongly, it depends very little on q. Okay. It's basically just a function of lambda. And the dependence of lambda is more or less what I told you earlier. If lambda was equal to k, it's 1. But then as lambda gets bigger than k, it basically increases as lambda over k. Okay. There's actually a simple way to understand why that's happening. So let me show you what's going on. The dominant contribution is coming from the region of momentum between k and lambda, where it looks like flat space. I can do the order of integration however I like, so let's just look at what's going on. So in this region between k and lambda, we said the propagator looked like 1 over q, e to the q times u minus v. Okay. So there's two propagators, so there's a 1 over q squared. I can rewrite these as u plus v and u minus v, so doing the u minus v integral brings down an additional factor of 1 over q. Okay. So if I take this d4q over q cubed, I get the lambda over k that I saw earlier, because it's only between k and lambda that the propagator behaves this way. And if I do the integral on u plus v, I basically get the size of the space. And the size of the space is basically log m Planck over TeV. That's how we define. That's how we chose the size of the space in order to generate the hierarchy. So doing the integration in this order, we see that this is the answer we should have expected. Okay. But notice that was critical to getting that answer was the fact that we had this cutoff at lambda over kq. Okay. So the results are you calculate the running of all the couplings. And there's lots of uncertainties that depend on models. Okay. Clearly, the gauge contribution we know because we just calculated the gauge bosons are in the bulk. Then for everybody else, the fermions, maybe there are scalars, everybody else, we have to decide what the model is. So do they sit on the brain? Do they sit in the bulk? If they are in the bulk, we know what their representation is. If the fermions are on the brain, we actually don't know what we should put in the bulk that corresponds to it unless we have a detailed model. That is to say, the fermions on the brain aren't contributing at higher momenta, but their existence on the brain tells us that there's something in the bulk that carries those quantum numbers. From the CFT point of view, they're forming bound states. From the bulk point of view, they're domain wall fermions or something. There has to be something in the bulk that carries those quantum numbers. So there's a lot of model uncertainty. But fortunately, the bulk of the contribution that tells you that couplings more or less unify comes from the gauge bosons themselves. Okay. So roughly speaking, you expect to get unification at the level of the standard model. Okay, that's what the red dotted lines are. I mean, this is a bit silly, but just to show that we can actually get unification very precisely, we just put in some random model just to get the couplings to unify better. The reason I say it's silly is there's the uncertainty in the calculation is at the level of the uncertainty of how many fermions you have, how many scalars you have. The bulk of the contribution comes from gauge bosons, and it's absolutely clear that the couplings have the possibility of unifying. It's well within the uncertainties of this calculation. Okay. So I find this actually quite encouraging because it really does make it quite reasonable that you could have a theory with gauge bosons in the bulk where you address the hierarchy and the couplings actually unify. I don't see any reason it's not possible. Like I said, there's uncertainties in the calculation. We certainly have done only a leading order calculation, and there are model uncertainties, but I still find that quite encouraging. And I say, I think this really was one of the arguments that was given against these extra-dimensional models addressing the hierarchy, and I think it just doesn't apply in this case. Okay. So any questions on that?
So does Would the coupling constant implication tell you something non-trivial about the bulk physics, or is it just?
Well, to get precision unification, it could tell you something, but it would require doing a calculation at next to leading order, at the very least. I mean, there's several uncertainties. There's also some uncertainties we're not going to be able to get around. I mean, we calculated the lambda over k times the logarithm correction, where that logarithm is about 35. But there's just lambda over k uncertainties, which are cutoff dependents that we can't say anything about. So we're always going to be at the level of a few percent uncertainty unless we know exactly what the cutoff is in the theory. Okay? So we can only do it to so much accuracy. Yes?
So the supersymmetric gut context, you actually have a specific model and it really unifies
right.
nicely. So what is the translation of that criteria to this?
Well, I mean, it's subjective. I mean, it's very nice that it unifies that accurately. Actually, it doesn't really unify that accurately. You actually need to put in threshold corrections, and the threshold corrections don't even seem to have the right signs. So, but it's clear that it looks very nice in the MSSM. And here we can't say as much, but you certainly can't say that you could rule out this model on the basis of unification.
Isn't what you call the MSSM, isn't that a special case of it's a field theory.
Yeah.
It has, I don't know, 50 fields, 40 fields, something like that.
Yes.
You said 10 was enough. I don't understand what the difference between what you're doing is and just field theory with a handful of fields.
Sorry, the difference between what? I mean, the MSSM is supersymmetric.
I don't understand the difference between this five-dimensional view and the four-dimensional view where you say there's a scale size.
Okay, so
is there a difference, or is it just a delay?
Okay, so here's something I would like to be answered, and then because I think it actually poses an interesting challenge for the holographic calculation, because we actually got this lambda over k piece from a region of space that was corresponding to flat space, right? So you'd want to see that you could reproduce this in the context of a holographic calculation from, say, the bound state modes. So it has to be some contribution, say, from Kaluza-Klein modes, which we know in detail how it happened because we did the five-dimensional calculation. In particular, I've been saying that lambda over k is the number of Kaluza-Klein modes. But if you actually look in detail, what happens is at any given momenta, it's the few Kaluza-Klein modes around that momenta that contribute. So on the TV brain, it's the TV mass Kaluza-Klein modes. On the 100 TV brain, it's the few Kaluza-Klein modes that are 100 TV in mass. So basically, to reproduce that in the holographic calculation, you'd have to somehow reproduce the fact that at different energies, it's different Kaluza-Klein modes that are contributing. And furthermore, it should reproduce it in such a way that I can actually get this flat space region, the region between k and lambda. So, that would be great. It would be very nice. I think it would be very nice to see that, because it would actually be something, a calculation that would be reproducing what you're getting in the flat space region.
If I just had the usual minimal supersymmetric or...
Okay, that's a different theory, the minimal
supersymmetric. I don't understand why it's a different theory.
It's supersymmetric. It's a different theory.
No, but I don't understand why it's not a special case of this.
Why the MSSM isn't a special case.
Why it isn't a special case of five-dimensional physics.
Oh, it might well be.
Of course it is. I mean, it has a size.
Yeah.
It has running the renormalization constants. In some sense, I think we're all beginning to believe that every quantum field theory, anything you can do in a quantum field theory, can be reflected as a deformation of some gravitational system in a higher dimension. I don't know if everybody believes that.
A
lot of us begin to believe that.
Well, okay, if you want to believe it, it's good to do calculations like this and show that actually they work.
if it's true, which some of us think is true,
yeah.
Then you ought to be able to translate back and forth from one to the other. Anything you find in one, you should find in the other.
Well, except for the fact that duality is, for better or for worse, usually a duality between a weakly coupled and a strong coupled theory. So usually I can only do the calculation on one side or the other. In this case, this is a weakly coupled theory in the bulk, so that's why I choose to do it there.
So you're imagining then that there's some very strongly coupled gauge theory above a TEV or something like that. You're imagining the physics thing. I mean, if I want to use the field theoretic language,
G squared n is I better take it so that it doesn't get that big, because I don't want
it. It's a weakly coupled gauge theory above the EV scale.
Right. It's not. And it's going to get strongly coupled just about at the unification scale for the limits of the parameters. Because it is running. From the point of view of the holographic theory, you can see that it's running. It has this n times logarithmic running.
Okay,
and that log is big.
Given that we can translate these things back and forth.
Well, we can't, though. I mean, we can't do it precisely. I mean, we could do it qualitatively.
The theory is weakly coupled. Why can't we study it as weakly coupled field theory, if it is weakly coupled field theory?
Like I said, okay, because how are you going to... So in the bulk... So once I... Wait, okay, let me say... Okay, so when we have two brains, the duality is literally a duality between the same fields, okay? So if I say I have... This occludes a Klein mode in the bulk... On the dual side, it's some bound state. I mean, it's the same field. So if I can say that the Kaluza-Klein mode contributes in a certain way in the bulk, I should be able to see that the bound state mode contributes the same way.
Some sector of the theory which is strong enough to have some interesting bound states at about the EV.
Right. Otherwise, I don't have an infrared brain. There's no sense in which I have an infrared brain.
The translation dictionary includes a dictionary for how the... Hierarchy.
Right. There has to.
And I think we would call it technicolor.
You can call it technicolor.
Well, it involves some running coupling constant, which gets big at about PEV, at which some kind of.
Well, we know something that breaks the conformal symmetry gets big at a TV. It may be the
FF. SU2 plus U1 symmetry.
What?
There also should be things which break SU2 plus U1.
That's right. So there has to be a Higgs bound state. That's right. I'm just saying that what triggers it could be some other operator other than F squared, but something is getting strong there, breaking the conformal symmetry from the point of view of the field theory, absolutely. So something has to be there to introduce the scale. Okay. And now, given that that's the case, there should be a way of translating the fact that the Kaluza-Klein modes were what gave you this lambda over K effect into the field theory. And I don't know if that calculation can be done. Okay. But, I mean, I think it's an important point. It would be very nice to see this. Okay. All right, are there any other questions about the unification part of the talk? Because I'm going to go on to the next part. Okay. So, this just says polyvalized gives the same answer, and I already kind of explained why that happens, so I'm not going to do that. Okay. But I think the important point is that, first of all, that we got that you can have unification. And at some level, this might have been obvious because there should be some sort of dual theory. But it was also really interesting to see exactly how the regulator that we used actually reduced the number of modes effectively so that it looked like a four-dimensional theory. Okay, so it's a bulk calculation that reproduced the results of a four-dimensional theory. Okay. To get the precise result, as I said, it was nice that we actually did that. Okay. But so somehow it's telling us that we're counting the Kaluza-Klein modes with this regulator. That is to say, with this position, with this cutoff that depends on position, and furthermore, moving in the boundary, we're getting the right number of modes that it corresponds to being a lower dimensional field theory. Okay, so I think I'm going to skip this because I'm out of time. So what I'd like to do now is think about how you could generalize this, okay? So suppose you have some curved space, and in particular, metrics of this form appear in many types, contexts, so that's the form of the metric we're going to consider now. That would include global, anti-de Sitter, static de Sitter, and black holes, okay? So there's lots of metrics of this form, okay? So to generalize what we had before, I'd say that there's a position-dependent cutoff, say, on energy, which is the square root of GTT of R lambda naught, okay? In this case, that would correspond to a square root of V of R times lambda, okay? Although that looks disturbingly non-covariant, it is equivalent, more or less, to polyvalars. The reason you can see that directly from the equation for a scalar field that has a mass m, in this curved background. You see, this should be a V here, not squared of V. So what occurs here is E squared over V phi plus this term involving momenta, and there's M squared phi here. So you see that if E squared over V is much bigger than M squared, essentially I can drop the M squared term, and I would find that the propagator for the massive Pauli-Villars mode would be the same as the propagator for the massless mode, which is to say they would cancel if I chose my Pauli-Villars appropriately. Below the mass M, I would only get the contribution from the zero mass field, which isn't being canceled, which is to say that I only get a contribution from E squared over V less than M squared. E squared over V greater than M squared, there's a cancellation. Okay, so this is precisely the bound that I'm putting above with our position-dependent cutoff. But this is to say that if you use Pauli-Villars, that would be the covariant version of what we're doing.
So if you have like string theory in the background, or string tension would effectively depend on Z and just
run on the Y. Right. That's right. So it makes sense for the exactly, and so it makes sense for the cutoff to vary this way. And in fact, right, the cutoff. Well, we will find cutoff dependence, which is exactly that fact that you need to know how it's cut off to get the precise answer. So we're not going to be able to give precise answers with numerical coefficients. We're just going to be able to see how it scales with the parameters in the problem, which I think is quite significant given that we're just doing field theory, and we can see this just from using the fact that the space is curved. Okay. So, again, we're doing precisely the same thing we did before. We're saying that if you have some energy E, there's going to be a position where beyond which you can't go and may have that energy E. That is to say, the cutoff will be below E if, in this picture, I go to the right of R sub E. Okay. So we're going to take R sub E as the boundary of space when we're dealing with energy E. That is to say, we're really going to be imposing the boundary conditions at R sub E. Okay. So basically what we're doing, quite generally, is we're saying, given an ultraviolet cutoff on energy, that translates into, if you like, an infrared cutoff. It's a bit loose, but it's a cutoff on position. Right? You can't go beyond this R sub E, given the existence of the ultraviolet cutoff. Okay. What I'm going to try to argue is that is enough to understand quite a lot about the reduction of states that you get in curved spaces. Not everything, but quite a bit. Okay. So as I said, we're dealing with metrics of this form. We have the equation for the scalar field. Now, if we were really hardy, we could try to find the real spectrum for all of these, but that would be much more work than we need to actually understand qualitatively what's going on. So we're actually going to use the same semi-classical WKB approximation that Atuf used when he counted the states exterior to a black hole when he puts a scalar field in the exterior of the black hole. Okay, to approximately count the states, he used a WKB method, which I will summarize on the next transparency. Okay. So this is the eigenvalue equation that you would have. Okay. So we parameterize the states as obviously using the angular momentum, the spherical harmonics. So that's what that L is. And so we try a solution of the form e to the I s of r. If you do that, you can solve for k s prime of r in terms of v of r. So then you can count the number of states. So you have 2L plus 1 dl and integral k dr. K we just found. So you get this. Then because you can see that L squared is bound to be less than E squared R squared over V, you can substitute that in, and you get the number of states, okay, in terms of V of R. Okay. So this is quite a useful formula. It's quite a nice formula. And I'm going to say more about it on the next transparency. But notice that what you see is that the number of states, this is again, this I should have said this, this we're assuming four dimensions now, which is what this E cubed goes. That's the fact that we have these L's. Okay, we're using YLMs. So the number of states goes like E cubed, okay? which is what it would do if you were in four dimensions and just had a flat space. Okay. Why doesn't it always scale as e cubed? Well, because remember, I said that this integral is up to a position r sub e, which is determined by the metric. Okay. So there's additional e dependence hidden in this integral. So, for example, if it went like 1 over e, we would find holographic behavior in the sense that it would look like one-dimensionless field theory. Okay. So it's this hidden e dependence that we're hoping will give us what we want. Okay. This g of e, this density of states, you can feed into, say, any kind of thermodynamics you want to do. You can just think of it as counting the states, or you can think of it in terms of doing the thermodynamics and deriving the entropy. If you were to do that, the dependence of entropy on temperature will mimic the dependence of the density of states on E. So if you like, you can think of this as entropy going like T cubed for if you're at temperature T. Okay. That formula is actually very nice, and it's also very easy to understand and generalize to additional dimensions. So what's going on? Well, of course, if you were in flat space, you'd have states would be R cubed, E cubed, okay, for a space of size R. That's kind of a silly formula to use if you're in a curved space. What you really want to do is use proper volume and local energy. So a more natural formula to use would be E over root V cubed, R squared dr over root V, where you can see immediately how this would generalize. So, which is to say, for example, in the ADS case, when we're counting states, we use the fact that the space is curved in computing the volume, but really, in general, you'd want to take into account the fact that your energy GTT is not 1, so this would be the more general formula, taking into account the curvature in both E and R. Okay, so this is really what your first guess was. This is really a good guess for what you'd expect. The only new step that we're putting in is we're saying that this integral will only go up to R sub E. It's okay, don't worry about it. So the integral only goes up to R sub E, okay? So what this is saying is that the number of states scales in this way, which is exactly the formula I had using the WKP method, okay? So we're basically counting the states, putting in this cutoff at the position R sub E, okay? So having said that, we can trivially do the Sitter space, for example, where V of R and the static coordinates given in the previous lecture was 1 minus r squared over r squared, r being the de Sitter curvature length. So we would define lambda of r by this formula. Okay, remember, r sub e you find by setting lambda of r sub e equals to e. Okay. So r sub e being near R, okay, that is to say, when R approaches the horizon, that's corresponding to the energy going up to the cutoff, okay? So again, what do we have here? We basically have this position-dependent cutoff corresponding to this energy E, okay? So let's just evaluate G of E, okay? So we said how to do that. G of E goes like E cubed integral RE, R squared dr over V of R squared. We said that if there was additional E dependence, then the energy dependence wouldn't be E cubed. And in fact, there is additional energy dependence. Because if you evaluate V of R, E, you see that it goes like E squared over lambda squared, okay? Which is to say that this integral will have an additional factor when after I've integrated over R of lambda squared over E squared. So V of E in this case goes like E R cubed lambda squared. So in terms of the cutoff dependence, it does look like one lower dimensional field theory. This E R cubed is a little perplexing. However, if you take it at the de Sitter temperature, which is what you should do in this case, then T R is basically 1, so this answer goes like R squared lambda squared. So that's to say this simple counting of the density of states imposing this cutoff in this way, okay, given an energy E, reproduces the area law that you would expect in de Sitter space. And it works very similarly in other examples. I mean, it works almost identically in the black hole example. It works a little bit differently in ADS spaces for reasons I can discuss, but it also gives area law. Okay. So One thing I just want to mention is that although it looks like the area law is representing a reduced number of states, in some sense it's representing a really high number of states given that you're saying that you're at the de Sitter temperature. Because if you were really naive, you would guess that it was T cubed R cubed. And actually what you're seeing is a lambda over T squared enhancement over that. And that's what's giving rise to the formula that we see at the end of the day, which is to say lambda squared R squared. So in some sense, it's a surprisingly large number of states. And it's just coming from the metric factors in the way I told you earlier. Which is to say that really what's contributing are the states that are at the cutoff scale. Because when you get near the horizon, you're looking at states that are near the cutoff scale. It doesn't go like that warp factor cube because there's an additional factor because of the dr itself that enters the volume. So this large enhancement is just a result of the metric. Okay. So I find this quite enlightening in the sense that you can see exactly where these area laws are coming from in the context of these curved spaces. Of course, it's not the whole story. It does work for all these examples that we know to be curved, which is nice. What is it missing? Well, it's missing, obviously, the physics of the cutoff, so we're not going to get a precise result. I think what you can say safely, though, is that the physics of the cutoff should have the same dependence on dimensions or in the parameters of the theory that this result does. In other words, it should be able to compensate for the cutoff dependence. So it's telling you how the cutoff has to look in terms of the R dependence, for example, and lambda dependence. I mean, it is lambda in a sense. The other thing of the other reason it doesn't work, of course, is that it's not ruling out all black holes. It's sort of ruling out small black holes by saying that you can't go beyond the cutoff, where the cutoff is roughly of order of the Planck scale. So I think if you really wanted to find it working, you would have to understand that physics as well. I think... like I said, it worked in these other examples, and I think it does give us a very simple picture of some aspects of holography. And I should say this really only works for time-independent metrics. We don't know how to generalize it to time-dependent metrics. But what I think is really nice is that you see directly that in these curved spaces there are just many fewer states than you would expect to see. And it's there; it's happening solely because of the curvature in these cases. The reason I actually think this was a worthwhile thing to do is that we would like to generalize what we've learned about holography from ADS-CFT. And in most cases, it's not going to be the boundary theory that generalizes. However, it could be that something we learned about the bulk theory generalizes. And we did our calculation, as I said, in the case of looking at unification in the bulk, and we found it looked four-dimensional. And somehow, the regularization procedure we use there should generalize. And by generalizing it, we do see that we get this reduced number of states that we expect. So I think... I mean, for these concrete examples, it's not mysterious why we get this reduced number of states. I mean, here, I just want to say we're never talking about a boundary theory, although we do find states are concentrated on the boundary or at the horizon in the case of black holes in de Sitter space. Again, our counting is basically only counting states in the field theory, and I said we don't have the physics of the cutoff, and we don't have the physics of black holes in here. So the extra states are presumably heavy states that aren't contributing a lot to the entropy, although one would want to include it. Comments I want to make are somehow that I find that it's somehow easier to think about this as the theory in the higher dimensional space, where some of the states are sort of getting, the states near the cutoff are getting caught up in black holes. It's like the sort of stored states. In other words, if I change the parameter of the space, it might be more useful to have a description in terms of the full volume of the space and see how many states there are that look like weakly coupled field theory states. The key thing that would be required, of course, to really understand holography, that is to say reduce dimensions beyond this, would be to include back reaction, which, of course, we're not including. So the real question would be, how would you exclude states that would say, how would you exclude intermediate states that would say form a large black hole? I mean, we haven't put that in. So that's why we don't, for example, see holography in flat space. We only see it in pre-existing curved space. However, given that we put in very little, I think it's quite useful and it's quite simple to just eyeball whether a state looks like a holographic theory in the sense of having this reduced dimensionality, and we see exactly where it's coming from. And maybe it'll be useful to understand other things. I think the upshot, though, is that it clearly gives some insight into area law. And so I will conclude there.
Questions?
Well.